For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Loeffler. Imagine walking beside an ox-drawn cart, or carreta, filled with your worldly possessions for 1,500 or so miles along a dirt road rough enough to bust an axle, sometimes wet enough to sink into, seemingly endless, always dangerous. Or maybe you'd be mounted on a horse or donkey, bouncing along on a saddle, herding sheep or cattle, hoping for water along the trail, looking for a paraje or campsite, with enough grass to feed the animals and firewood enough to provide fire for cooking and warmth. Part of the journey extended through the Jornada del Muerto, a 90-mile stretch where the water was sparse to non-existent. Such was the nature of life along El Camino Real de Tierra Adentro, the royal road to the interior. Here, Mark Simmons speaks of traveling through the Jornada del Muerto, the journey of the dead man.
Usually, they made it in about 3.5 to 4 days. Sometimes they made it faster. When Oñate went ahead of his own caravan, he made it fairly quickly, within two and a half days, going horseback. And then the wagon train was moving slower, so it came behind. They'd always push the hard as they could to get past that. Then they'd reach the paraje, the Fray Cristobal, at the end, that is going north. That was the last paraje as you came out of the desert, and that was alongside the Rio Grande. So they would generally stop there for 2 or 3 days to recuperate. Plenty of water, some firewood along the bosques there, which within a few years were probably pretty well stripped. And then they'd graze on the little mesas above the river. When they proceeded upriver, the parajes that were established along the Rio Grande were all comfort sites. And that was true later when caravans in the late colonial period were coming from upper New Mexico and going down to the Valle de San Bartolome at the north of Socorro until they got to the paraje de Fray Cristobal and they entered the desert. So they'd have good times the several nights they were in the bosque down there in central New Mexico.
Because of the aridity of the desert trek through the Jornada del Muerto, it was imperative that the livestock load up on water before crossing that span of desert. John Roney tells us about the Paraje de San Diego.
Yeah, Paraje San Diego, it's located near the Upham exit between Las Cruces and Hatch. That's the area where the Camino Real begins to leave the river and veer off into the Jornada del Muerto. It's a place where you can come up onto sort of the flat level surface that's the Jornada del Muerto, and you're several miles away from the river at that point. But people could still drive their livestock down and give them one last deep drink of water before they started out across the Jornada del Muerto. So that Paraje San Diego was an important camping place. And in the late 1980s, we did an archaeological project there. One thing we found is that that particular paraje seems to have been used almost exclusively prior to the Pueblo Revolt, prior to 1680. It was almost no glass, practically no metal artifacts that could be related to travel along the Camino Real, but a lot of pottery. The pottery that was found there was from New Mexico. They found glaze-painted, Rio Grande glaze paint pottery. It's a real distinctive kind of decoration that Indians did in New Mexico, but only prior to the Pueblo Revolt. During the time when the Spanish were holed up in El Paso, they changed their pigments and began making completely different pottery after that. So part of the pottery is Mayolica, which is a ceramic tradition that came from Seville in Spain and was transplanted to Puebla in central Mexico and also in Mexico City. And they produced these kind of fancy decorated wares that people would use for soup bowls and cups. Because they were produced in these two centers and are distributed so widely, they're pretty well understood. So we know really well from the kinds that were represented there that the use of that area ended around 1680. The other really interesting thing there was a piece of Chinese porcelain. That would have been somebody's prized possession. It would have been something that was produced in China, probably during the Ming Dynasty, and that would have come across on the Manila Galleon to Acapulco, and then somehow made its way from Acapulco up to a place north of the Pass of the North and been broken and lost there.
Parajes were selected for the availability of three different resources which were needed by a traveling caravan. They needed the grass for the grazing of the livestock overnight. They needed firewood for cooking. And of course, the most essential, they needed water. Sometimes the Jornada had some grass, but often it wasn't close to the wagon trains after a few passed by in the area in the immediate vicinity of the Camino Real that Oñate was establishing. A pretty wide swath had been grazed off. there were some, probably some desert shrub. We don't know exactly what the vegetation pattern was there. I've read accounts from the 19th century that they had some good years and the Jornada was a waving sea of grass, stirrup high. If they had some of these shrubs that are now like greasewood and some of the others that provide kind of woody stems and so on, that could have been used for fuel. So you may have had a bit of that. But in any case, Oñate selected campsites, which were just designated rest stops half day apart, and they were places that, while maybe not providing much in the way of comforts or necessities, nevertheless, were a place that you intended to reach at your next stop. It was a goal to be reached if you were going to make a rapid crossing of the Jornada. And sometimes they would double up and travel all night, for example, but they were always limited in their forced marches by the condition of the livestock.
Archaeologist Mike Marshall has spent many years following ancient trails through Mexico and the American Southwest.
They struck out from the river and headed north. They apparently knew enough about the country to not follow that river. They sent out advance parties to scope things out. And as they entered the desert, they sent out their advance party, and they were looking for water, and they hadn't found it. A little dog shows up that they had on the expedition. They look down, they see mud on its feet, and they track it back to this mud hole. It was a little water hole. From that time on, it was called Ojo de Perillo, Little Dog Spring. And later on, the area was called the Sierra Perillo. There's a little mountain range there. They named the mountain range that. And later on, the Apaches lived out there, became the Apaches de Perillo. And so the name kind of got wider geographic area. So I was able to track down and find this campsite of Little Dog Springs. It's a very singular, very isolated location. There's empty desert country on either side. It's just a mud hole. There's an arroyo there, a Rincon arroyo that comes down by a windmill there, and it's got some cobblestone floor there. It's the only place in that area where there's cobbles. And the water collects in these little charcos, or little pools, little tinajas, and that's where this water hole was. If you're there in the summertime, you just understand what it's all about, because you can look off across these empty desert expanses in either direction as far as you can see, with mirages shimmering out there in this ocean of creosote just going out and out and out and out. And then here's this little muddy hole, you know, and that's it. I mean, that's the life-giving substance. It's just right there. I mean, without that, everything, you know, you can't make it across here. You're going to die if you don't have that little mud hole. And you can just see people stumbling in there, you know, beat up, lips cracked, you know, sunburned, you know, worn down, just stumbling down into that thing on there, dropping on their hands and knees, you know, splashing water on their face and laughing, and, you know, just, they're saved, you know. And you can just see it there. It's just right, it's like almost like a presence there that hovers around it, you know. Up on the banks around this thing are these little fireplaces. Then I started finding pieces of olive jar and like a broken piece of a mirror, you know, things like this from these caravans that go by. And it's just so solitary, so empty, you know. And you know that De Vargas was sitting there, you know, that Oñate sat up on the rocks and looked down at this caravan. You know, it's just, it's such a small, insignificant little place, but yet it's almost like a gateway or monument, like sort of like Plymouth Rock or something, where people, because this is the beginning of the entrance into New Mexico.
Joe Sanchez tells us about how the Jornada del Muerto probably got its name.
It may still leave a lingering doubt as to how the Jornada del Muerto gets its name. When we consider the origins of it, maybe we should take into account the story of Bernardo Gruber. And Gruber is a fascinating account all by himself, because here's a German from somewhere deep in the heart of Germany who somehow migrates into Spanish territory. Bernardo Gruber, in the 17th century, in the 1660s, somehow makes his way into the Spanish Empire, comes to the Americas, ends up as a trader in Sonora. No one knows how and why he thought of coming to New Mexico, but in the late 1660s, he ends up in New Mexico. Gruber must have been a fascinating individual. Spanish speaking, into the culture, makes friends, probably very diplomatic, obviously successful in trader, looking for new markets, and ends up over here at Salinas, the pueblo of Cuaray. He ends up there on Christmas Day while Christmas Mass was being said. He must have been there for several weeks prior to that. And maybe as a prank, no one knows exactly why he did this, goes up into the choir loft while Mass is being said. He does it for a reason, because he says in his homeland, while Mass is going on Christmas Day, you have some little papers that you put A-D-N-A with a cross and then repeat the letters again. And while Mass is going on, you eat those papers, you can gain immortality. And so he convinces a couple of choir people to do it. They do. They chew the papers up and they swallow them. And these are Native Americans at Quaray who have been Hispanicized. One of them goes out after Mass, and I think he's also a prankster, and he picks up an awl, A-W-L. So he picks up this awl and he holds it in front of the people at the pueblo, and he strikes down on his leg as hard as he can, and it doesn't pierce it, and then the blood comes out, and people are like, you know, it must be true. And so Bernardo Gruber probably got a laugh out of this. But one of the institutions that came up the Camino Real in 1626 was the Holy Office of the Inquisition chapter of New Mexico. And they have a commissary, Father Juan de Paz. One of the settlers there decides, well, you know, this just isn't right. He violated the sanctity of the Mass by walking up there, working a spell, which we don't know if it's black magic or witchcraft or what the deal is here. And we'd like to have this investigated. So they make a report to the commissary of the Inquisition, who then orders the arrest of Gruber. They hold him at Quaray, and they realize that Quaray is not strong enough to hold anybody prisoner. And they say, you know, the strongest place we have to hold him is up here at San Diego Pueblo, at Ortega's Hacienda. And so they take him up there to San Diego Pueblo, and there they hold him prisoner. The Inquisition of New Mexico did not have the power to hold a trial, but they did have the power to investigate. The investigation takes place, and you would have thought that the investigation would have been quick and simple, but it didn't happen that way. Over 2 years pass, and Gruber's herds, while they were in the care of people he trusted, are now being spread out and sold out. They're dying. He's losing his horses. All the stuff that he brought up for trade is now being lost. And Gruber himself is charging that, turn me loose to take care of my business, and why are you holding me? And finally he has no choice but to find a way to escape. With Gruber on his arrest was an Apache named Atanasio. Atanasio is a good Apache, probably from Sonora, knows his way around. He's a young guy, can handle himself, but he's very loyal to Gruber. For nights on end, Atanasio visits the cell and passes some food along to Gruber. So they make these plans to have a horse arranged. And Gruber then digs out the cell window, because it's adobe, and loosens the pegs that hold the window. And then on the appropriate night, which is at midnight on June 20th, 21st, they decide to strike for the escape. Gruber is held in shackles. He's held in handcuffs as well as leg irons. And in order for him to make his escape, he has to figure out how to get out. So he feigns a sickness in his side. He has terrific pain, and he needs to have the shackles removed, and the guard comes in and removes them. And once that's done, then the path is made clear. Gruber then, at midnight, with Atanasio, make their escape. They break out the window. He crawls out, gets on the horse, and they ride southward as fast as they can down the bosque from San Diego Pueblo, moving quickly. Sometime around 1 or 2 in the morning, they come to the ranch of Tomé. They meet his son. I don't, he must have been out carousing. Where, we don't know. And Tomé's son, Tomé Dominguez de Mendoza, says, what are you guys doing? And I says, well, you know, we just need you to keep quiet about this and we need to move on. And so they move on. Next day, Ortega and his men, with the orders of the Inquisition, have a posse, and they're running down the trail, and they come to Tomé's place, and they ask Tomé Dominguez de Mendoza for fresh horses and mules to carry on the chase, and he refuses. He says, not my problem. He was your prisoner. You lost him, and we're not about to do anything for you. But meanwhile, Gruber makes it all the way down to Socorro, and Atanasio gets some food there. And they continue the route around today's Jornada del Muerto. Somewhere in there, at a place called El Alemán, which was so named then, obviously after Gruber, something happens. We don't know what happened. The posse, first of all, lost the trail. They couldn't find him. Meanwhile, Atanasio comes back to Socorro and talks to the missionary there, who arrests Atanasio and holds him, thinking he can hold an Apache. And they accuse him of having murdered Bernardo Gruber. They think they're holding this Apache, but somewhere during that time, he escapes too, never to be heard of again. Meanwhile, months later, down at a place called Aleman, they find the remains of someone and had the clothing of Bernardo Gruber still on him. And they declare that Gruber is dead.
Francis Levine is the director of the Palace of the Governor's History Museum.
The frontier of New Mexico and the frontier of Mexico met somewhere on the Camino Real. And when you're in the Rio Abajo region, you really are in that transition zone. In ecology, we talk about an ecotone. And an ecotone is where one plant community joins with another. And so you have a little bit of desert and a little bit of pino and juniper that grow and intermingle. And I think of a frontier as a kind of cultural ecotone, a place where the culture of one area and the culture of another area begin to meet and combine to form something wholly new that is a combination of the two distinct culture areas. The period of exploration, Coronado's expedition, and the expeditions that followed, the Espejo, Chamuscado Rodriguez, the Castaño de Sosa expedition, all of these expeditions between 1540 and 1591, although they didn't lead to a settlement of New Mexico, this is like first contact. And that moment of first contact when somebody first sees a horse, a man in armor, these are mind-shattering concepts to see this technology that is not something you've ever heard or known about. Now, that said, I can't believe that the Pueblos hadn't already heard about the Spanish. The Spanish had been in the Valley of Mexico since 1519, and I can't believe that stories hadn't come up here, so that the Spanish had heard from Mexican Indian traders that there were these people who rode horses, had firearms, but seeing them for the first time could not have left a culture unchanged.
Oñate is in the province of the Piro Pueblos at that time. The Piro is now extinct, but that whole stretch of the Socorro Valley was a haven for these scattered Pueblos up and down the river. And he must have been, oh, about in the middle of the province, and the Indians had fled at his approach. So he was in need of purchasing foodstuffs for the wagon trade. And so he came to a village, one of these Piro Pueblos, and the people, instead of fleeing, flocked out of the rooftops to see the Spanish expedition. And the leader of the Pueblo came out and apparently by signs conversed with Oñate and convinced him they were friendly. Oñate needed food, and so they were supplied bountifully with corn. They obviously had a considerable surplus there. To commemorate that incident and in a sense to give thanks, he named the Pueblo Socorro, meaning aid or relief, which is what the corn supplied his expedition. The last of the Piros went out of that valley at the time of the Pueblo Revolt in 1680, and there were no inhabitants, European inhabitants there, until very late in the colonial period, just a few years before the colonial period was over. The king and viceroy had been ordering the establishment of some settlement south of Belen to shorten the distance on the road between the last New Mexican settlements and the El Paso Valley. There was that huge vacant area, and it meant the wagon caravans went a long way before they could find relief if they were in trouble of some kind. Socorro was a good place to reoccupy an area to the south. I did find a document which established that, I'm trying to remember the date, 1816, when a formal community of Socorro was established. It was sort of a reestablishment of the original Socorro Pueblo, where there had been a mission and large vineyards. And the first wine production, I think, is mentioned there at Socorro in the 1620s. So that was an important area, but it was just a pass-through area for much of the colonial period.
There were ideas that went back and forth between the New Mexican indigenous communities and the Mexican nation indigenous communities for long before there was a road. For me, the Camino Real as a formal road is a symbol of empire. But those ideas traveled up and down long before there was a road and traveled up even in places where the Camino Real didn't touch. I'm very conscious of the Camino Real defining a particular time period and defining a frontier, an empire, the presence of an empire, but not governing all of the contacts that went up and down that very permeable boundary between New Mexico and Mexico.
It is impossible for the modern mind to grasp the enormity of culture shock that was experienced by the Puebloan Indians as Spanish colonists entered territory continuously inhabited by ancestral Puebloans and other indigenous peoples for thousands of years. In Puebloan culture, individualism was subordinated by community-oriented endeavors of practice. In Spanish culture, the individual rose as high in the social hierarchy as his circumstances allowed. The Puebloans celebrated their annual cycle of ceremonial religious practices within a sacred landscape, inhabited by fellow species and local deities, including the plumed serpent known to inhabit the Rio Grande. The Spaniards marched forward in their certainty of the presence of a single deity whose residence lay beyond the sky. The Puebloans lived their lives in the present. The Spaniards placed their faith in a posthumous future. Herman Aguayo is a member of the San Juan Pueblo, the very Pueblo near where Juan de Oñate settled on the site of his first Spanish capital.
When we're trying to tell the story about the first capital, Yungue, and that was converted into, you know, the first capital by Oñate, and named it San Gabriel. So there's a number of significant, what you might call first, happening at the first capital site. Probably the first outdoor oven was built there. Of course, the first church was built there. There's documents that Oñate and his colony built some kind of a church here at San Juan Pueblo because there was church services held on September 8, 1598. And a number of tribal leaders from various pueblos were here. And after all this ceremony would happen, then various priests were assigned to them, and so when they left, they took a priest with them. And the Moors and the Christianos conflict or battle, that was reenacted here as part of the September ceremony. And then the first action of declaring war against a pueblo was that decision was made at the first capital site when they decided to attack Acoma.
About a dozen of Oñate's soldiers stopped at Acoma Pueblo. This would have been in the latter half of 1599 and put in a demand. They needed food or grain. They were on their way to rejoin Oñate's expedition set out from San Juan Pueblo and was at that time in Zuni. Oñate was planning to go and try to find the South Sea, that is the Pacific. He thought it was much closer than it was. Anyway, he was waiting at Zuni for his nephew, Juan de Zaldívar, and second-in-command to come up with some reinforcements. There were about a dozen soldiers with Zaldívar in that party. They stopped at Acoma, demanded food, and the Acoma said, well, you'll have to camp overnight. It has to be ground on the metates by the women. They wanted cornmeal. And so they waited, and then they were invited up on the rock to pick up the grain, and they got there. Several of the soldiers had been left on the ground with the horses. Zaldívar and his men went on top, and they were immediately set upon by all sides in a furious battle. And they were all slain, except two or three, perhaps, leaped off the rock, and two survived. They landed in sand dunes blown up against the base of the cliff, and that cushioned their fall. Third one of the Robledo brothers, hit rocks below and was killed. Then those survivors went out and spread the word that Acoma's rebellion, the second in command of the expedition, had been killed. So Oñate went through a very elaborate procedure, according to Spanish law, to determine if war was justified, if he could conduct just war against Acoma. And the clergy were called for their opinion, and it was their view that Spaniards were entitled to conduct just war against the Acomas. The Acomas apparently were saying, and they record this in the Spanish documents, that as soon as they completely vanquished the Spaniards, then they were going to march on the Rio Grande and destroy the Rio Grande Pueblos for having welcomed the Spaniards. Again, we don't know that that's the case, but it's certainly plausible given the past record of Acoma. Oñate was going to lead the punitive expedition to assault Acoma, but his officers universally agreed that he should stay at San Juan, because if they failed and the army was overcome, and it was certainly in doubt at the time when they marched away, that 70 men were sent to attack the Rock of Acoma. They had no guarantee they were going to succeed. And if they failed and the army was decimated, then their position in Mexico would be totally untenable. They'd have to give up the whole enterprise, and Oñate would be needed to lead the surviving colonists at San Juan out of New Mexico, they'd probably have to fight their way through, because all the Pueblos were watching to see what the Spaniards would do. So the younger brother of Juan de Zaldivar, Vicente, went and approached Acoma. They had interpreters now. They were shouting to the Acomas on top to surrender and hand over those persons responsible for the killing of the Spaniards. And the Acomas met them with jeers and throwing down stones on them and jagged pieces of ice they were using as missiles. Vicente took this to mean a rejection of Spanish terms. A battle of several days followed, and the Spaniards ended up seizing the rock and destroying the Pueblo, taking captives. They had only one casualty. Spaniards attributed their victory to divine intervention. About 24 men were hauled back to Santo Domingo Pueblo. A courier sent to Oñate, and he came down with part of his remaining force to Santo Domingo. And there they held a trial of these men who were between 25 and 40 years of age. They were considered of the warrior class, and so they were condemned to have one foot cut off as punishment for rebellion, the killing of the Spaniards.
In 1609, it was decided to move the capital from San Gabriel, near the San Juan Pueblo, to Santa Fe, on the banks of the Santa Fe River. An Indian Pueblo had been established there around 850 AD, but was abandoned by 1410. By 1610, the flag of Spain was unfurled above the Palace of the Governors, and the plaza immediately in front of the palace marked the official endpoint of El Camino Real de Tierra Adentro. Caravans under the auspices of the King of Spain made infrequent trips between Mexico City and Santa Fe. John Roney tells us more.
This mission supply service was organized really early in the history of the colony in New Mexico. When Oñate came in 1598, it was around 1609, I think, that the King of Spain decided that as a matter of charity, he would support the Franciscan missions. This was something to help in the salvation of his own soul. So he agreed to support the Franciscan missions, and a part of the support consisted of funding these caravans that would travel from Mexico City to New Mexico. It would take about a year and a half to organize an expedition, and then the round trip, it would take 6 months from Mexico City to New Mexico. They'd have about 6 months in New Mexico to reorganize, and then another six-month trip back. Theoretically, they were supposed to make that trip about every 3 years, but in reality, sometimes it was 4, 5, 6 years between trips. And that was really the main contact that people in northern New Mexico had with the rest of the Spanish Empire. A lot of the time, there wasn't much other traffic along the Camino Real between these periods when the caravans would come. And when travelers wanted to come to New Mexico, there might be new colonists, new governor, priests that were assigned to New Mexico. They would wait until a caravan left and travel with that caravan. Some historians have described these caravans as having been composed of these really large fortified wagons or carretas. They'd have a military escort, because 800 miles of that trip was through areas that were not settled by Europeans. They would have to carry everything with them that they'd need along that journey.
The Lore of the Land is sponsored by the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. This segment is funded by a grant from the United States Bureau of Land Management with the continuing support of the Ford Foundation. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.